Hey, welcome to this episode of Light 'Em Up. We take a deep dive on the criminal justice system, crime scene investigation, and leadership. We enlighten, educate, and empower others with the truth. Like it or not, the truth disturbs, the truth divides, but ultimately, the truth delivers. Hey, I'm your host, Phil Rizzo. I'm the principal owner of Rizzo's Protective Group. We are a high-risk security consulting firm headquartered out of Akron, Ohio, and with offices in the Bronx, New York, and Cerro Alto, the Dominican Republic. Hey, as we put the ball on the tee to line things up for kickoff, we speak life, health, and prosperity over each and every one of you, and we want to thank you for joining us. Tonight, on this educational and empowering edition of Light 'Em Up, ripped straight from the headlines from the Atlanta Fulton County Superior Court, located at 136 Pryor Street in downtown Atlanta, Georgia, the Peachtree State, as 19 people, including the 45th President of the United States, are indicted. Donald J. Trump has now made history in that he's the only former U.S. president that has been indicted four times over and has been issued his very own personal criminal identification number, which is P0113589 in this case. The leading candidate for the Republican Party nomination for president in next year's election on Friday, August 25th, spent about 20 minutes at the Lewis R. Slayton Fulton County Courthouse and Jail. Submitting to some of the routine actions of the criminal defendant intake process, where he was fingerprinted and had his now infamous mugshot taken. A mugshot that he's using to raise millions of dollars to assist him on the campaign trail and with covering the costs of his rising legal fees. This was the same process earlier in the week for another one of his named co-conspirators, one Rudolph William Louis Giuliani, who was once considered to be America's mayor, the man who skillfully led us through the darkest days following 9/11 and the attacks on the World Trade Center towers in the capital of the world, New York City, in 2001. Both men and 17 others find themselves in El Ojo del Huracán, or in the eye of the hurricane, and at the epicenter of an indictment that spans 41 counts in its entirety. Both Trump and Giuliani are facing 13 felony counts under the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, simply known as RICO, or the RICO statutes, as they are being applied at the state level in Georgia for their alleged collective attempts in a wide-ranging conspiracy to overturn the state's 2020 election results. Hey, here's the quid pro quo. Don't move a muscle and keep it locked where you got it. As we dive in and define what the RICO Act is, its purpose and scope, and as we provide contextual and historical background of its legislative origins. Hey, oddly enough, but true, this legislation was signed into law by President Richard, I am not a crook, Nixon in 1970. Now, clearly, while time won't permit us in covering everything that needs to be covered, we do hope to advance the ball downfield in a meaningful way that educates and empowers you, our listener. Also in the process, we'll compare and contrast a current headline-grabbing racketeering case currently underway in the very same courthouse as rapper Young Thug, whose real name is Jeffrey Williams, is on trial as well under the RICO statutes. Hey, all this y mucho, mucho más aquí y solamente aquí on this explosive investigatory edition of Light 'Em Up. Hey, for starters, as we know that inquiring minds want to know, let's define the focus of this special and specific episode. You might be curious hearing all about this on every news channel on TV. You might be asking, what is the Federal Racketeering, Influenced, and Corrupt Organizations Act all about? In 1967, the U.S. Senate proposed two bills that would enhance the penalties for certain organized crime activities in commercial ventures. Although Congress did not act on either bill, the hearings regarding the bills eventually spawned the first real version of RICO when the Senate considered it in 1969. The Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO, was passed on October 15, 1970, as a means by which the federal government could combat organized crime. RICO was enacted as Title IX of the Organized Crime Control Act, also known as the OCCA. The act today is covered in 18 U.S.C. sections 1961 through 1968 and provides the legal means by which prosecutors can identify and convict those who operate illegal businesses. Now, more than 50 years ago, the U.S. was in a very different place than it is today. Organized crime in the United States was a highly sophisticated, diversified, and widespread activity that annually drained and continued to drain billions of dollars from America's economy by unlawful conduct and the illegal use of force, fraud, and corruption. In the Racketeering Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, Congress had established that organized crime derives a major portion of its power through money obtained from such illegal endeavors as syndicated gambling, loan sharking, the theft and fencing of property, you name it, as well as the importation and distribution of narcotics and other dangerous drugs, and other forms of social exploitation as well. The money from these illegal activities and the power it cultivates were increasingly used to infiltrate and corrupt legitimate businesses and labor unions and to subvert and corrupt our democratic process and processes. With this legislation, Congress further established that organized crime activities in the United States weakened the stability of the nation's economic system, harmed and continued to harm innocent investors and competing organizations. It interfered with free competition and seriously burdened and continues to burden interstate and foreign commerce. It threatened the domestic security and undermined the general welfare of the nation and its citizens. Now, at the same time, anyone who was paying even the slightest attention could see that organized crime continued to grow because of defects in the evidence-gathering process of the law, which inhibited the development of the legally admissible evidence necessary to bring criminal and other sanctions or remedies to bear on the unlawful activities of those engaged in organized crime. And this was crucially important because of the sanctions and remedies available to the government were unnecessarily limited in its scope, nature, and its impact. Hey, let's take some time here to talk with you about the roots of RICO. Now, as we mentioned, RICO initially was enacted October 15th of 1970 as Title IX of the Organized Crime Control Act, or the OCCA. The roots of RICO, however, extend as far back as 1950, when the problem of criminal infiltration of legitimate businesses was first documented. In the 1960s, antitrust laws were used to attack this criminal activity in business. The extent of the problem motivated Congress to develop direct criminal legislation to combat patterned infiltration of legitimate businesses by organized and non-organized criminal activity. Now, RICO is the result of the assimilation of several strong Senate bills modified by the House of Representatives. Congress found that organized crime, particularly La Cosa Nostra, LCN, had extensively infiltrated and exercised corrupt influence over numerous legitimate businesses and labor unions throughout the United States, and hence posed a new threat to the American economic system. Closely paralleling its takeover of legitimate businesses, organized crime has moved into legitimate labor unions. The control of labor supply through control of unions can prevent the unionization of some industries or can guarantee sweetheart contracts in others. It provides the opportunity for theft from union funds, extortion through the threat of economic pressure, and the profit to be gained from the manipulation of welfare and pension funds and insurance contracts. Trucking, construction, and waterfront entrepreneurs had been offered labor peace in exchange for support of gambling, loan sharking, and pilferage. The commandeering by organized crime of any legitimate businesses cannot be tolerated. New remedies were necessary because of the inadequacy of existing remedies. New approaches were needed as well that would deal not only with individuals, but also with the economic base through which those individuals constitute such a serious threat to the economic well-being of the nation. In short, an attack must be made on their source of economic power itself, and the attack must take place on all available fronts. RICO recognizes that present efforts to dislodge the forces of organized crime from legitimate fields of endeavor had proven unsuccessful. Now, to remedy this failure, the proposed statute adopted the most direct route open to accomplish the desired objective. Where an organization is acquired or is run by defined racketeering methods, then the persons involved can be legally separated from the organization either by the criminal law approach of fine and imprisonment and forfeiture, or through a civil law approach of equitable relief broad enough to do all that is necessary to free the channels of commerce from all illicit activity. RICO legislation was designed to fight the infiltration of organized crime into legitimate business organizations, unions, and government. The overarching purpose of RICO was to whack, once and for all, organized crime in the United States by strengthening the legal tools in the evidence-gathering process and by establishing new penal prohibitions and by providing enhanced sanctions and new remedies to deal with the unlawful activities of those engaged in organized crime. A criminal RICO prosecution is used when speaking of someone facing serious criminal charges relating to organized crime and racketeering. This law has extremely sharp teeth, unlike much I've ever seen before. Trust me when I tell you, the age-old metaphor which states, when you cut off the head of the snake, the body will die. Certainly, the RICO statutes make this adage very true. The Racketeering Act passed the Senate with the vote of 74-1, with 25 people not voting, and the House with a 341-26 resounding majority. It was drafted and designed to be the ultimate hitman in mob prosecutions. Now, it's a fact that the U.S. government came late to the game in fighting organized crime. Some say the Roaring Twenties was the birth of the organized crime era in the U.S. Gangsters rolled in loads of cash by manufacturing and selling alcohol to thousands of speakeasies or illegal drinking establishments spread across the cities, and the bootlegging business got so big that it needed more structure. While Americans of the Prohibition era followed the violent careers of gangsters like Al Capone, those types of criminals were generally seen as local groups, limited to a city or a small region rather than being a national syndicate. The FBI, under the direction of J. Edgar Hoover, began keeping tabs on individual gangsters and modernizing their investigation and enforcement tactics. And by the late 1930s, notorious criminals had largely been arrested or killed. But the problem persisted. In 1949, the American Municipal Association, which represented more than 10,000 cities, petitioned the government to take more immediate measures against organized crime, reporting that illegal gambling and interstate crime were going unchecked by the federal government. At the association's prompting, Senator Estes Kefauver helped create a committee to investigate the problem. When the Kefauver Committee proceedings were televised in March 1951, approximately 30 million Americans tuned in. The population was just 150 million at that time. These hearings are memorably fictionalized in Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather Part II. But while Kefauver's commission found plenty of evidence for interstate gambling, the rise of narcotics trade, and the infiltration of legitimate businesses and law enforcement agencies by gangsters, they failed to convince the federal government to take concerted action against organized crime. Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, refused to even acknowledge the existence of an American mafia. By the 1950s, intelligence agencies and the Department of Justice turned their attention to what they saw as matters of greater importance: anti-communism. The Cold War was slowly heating up, and getting bogged down by supposedly small-scale domestic crime seemed like a waste of resources. Most federal agencies and the government were focused almost entirely on subversion, communism, issues with the Cold War, says Lee Bernstein, a professor of history at State University of New York, New Paltz. Something like organized crime seemed like a relic of an earlier age, a throwback to some of the gangsters of the earlier Prohibition period. Hoover repeatedly dismissed the notion that a network of criminals like the Mafia might be operating on a national scale. In the FBI's New York field office, 400 special agents were assigned to ferreting out subversives, while only 4 were charged with investigating organized crime. And while Hoover accumulated personal files on 25 million people over the course of his tenure, most of them, from the period before the 1950s, contained information on suspected communists and other antagonists rather than on criminals or gangsters. Once the Federal Bureau of Investigation acknowledged the Mafia's existence in late 1957, after an infamous meeting of mobsters in upstate New York was raided after a state trooper overheard the son of mob boss Joseph Barbara booking hotel rooms for out-of-state visitors. Then, and only then, did the Bureau seek to identify, categorize, and organize its members into families, although the genealogy stopped abruptly at the Eastern Atlantic coast. Within 4 days of the Barbara meeting, on November 18th, Hoover ordered the creation of an anti-mob initiative. Shortly thereafter, he created the Top Hoodlum Program and authorized the use of illegal wiretaps to track down criminals. The FBI acknowledgement of the existence of an American mafia marked a major turning point in the battle against organized crime. Another major turning point was to come in 1962, when Joseph Valachi became an informant on the mob's vast activities. Valachi held a rank in the mafia equivalent to that of a sergeant, with interest chiefly in the numbers rackets and other gambling activities from the 1930s to the 1950s. In 1959, he was convicted of narcotics violations and sentenced to 15 to 20 years in prison. In June 1962, in the federal prison at Atlanta, Georgia, crime boss Vito Genovese, a fellow inmate, suspecting him incorrectly of having become an informer, gave him the kiss of death, a sign that he was to be killed. Valachi panicked. He killed a fellow prisoner who he mistakenly thought was his assassin, and in revenge against the death threat, told all to the U.S. Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the FBI, the Justice Department, and in 1963 to the U.S. Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, headed up by John L. McClellan. Valachi was the first syndicate member ever to describe the history, membership, and inner workings of the National Crime Cartel. Valachi was the first syndicate member ever to describe the history, membership, and the inner workings of the National Crime Cartel, popularly called the Mafia. What Valachi termed La Cosa Nostra, our thing. U.S. Attorney General Robert Kennedy called his testimony the biggest single intelligence breakthrough yet in combating organized crime and racketeering in the United States. Investigations, indictments, and convictions followed Valachi's testimony. Now let's pause just for a minute to think about what we've heard so far. If you were to ask me, I think it's mind-boggling how Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, could have for so long denied the existence of what was known by every big city beat cop and street punk knew to be common knowledge. There was a mafia. There were wise guys. It was thought that Director Hoover had resisted throwing his agents into a war against organized crime for fear that they might show up badly or fall prey to corruption. Hoover knew how tricky such investigations might be and didn't want to risk tarnishing the reputation of the FBI by getting involved in cases that couldn't be solved. But it's inconceivable to think that J. Edgar Hoover didn't know of the mafia. More closer to reality, Hoover knew of the strength and brutality of the mob and probably felt that any acknowledgement of a nationwide or international organized crime conspiracy would bring calls for an interagency national law enforcement response, which he sensed could easily destroy the legendary independence and primacy of the agency that he had built virtually single-handedly since taking control of the 16-year-old Bureau of Investigation in 1924. It's also no coincidence that the Bureau's undercover program was launched only after Hoover's death in 1972. Now, for the members of our Criminal Justice and Forensic Science class, level 3500, who are accessing this broadcast through their Google Classroom portal and are listening in as one of their first assignments of the brand new school calendar year, I'm pretty confident that you can remember from previous episodes of Light 'Em Up and from our in-class and virtual discussions the difference between civil law having to do with the recovery of money and its requisite burden of proof being 50.1%, and criminal law, which is focused on the possibility of sanctions that will take away someone's freedom, with the burden of proof required to find someone guilty is unanimous and proof beyond a reasonable doubt, a much higher and more difficult burden to achieve, with misdemeanors being punishable by 6 months or less in jail, with possible exposure to financial penalties as well, and felonies being punishable by 1 year or more of prison time with exposure to monetary fines also. Keep this clear in your mind. RICO provides powerful criminal penalties for persons who engage in a pattern of racketeering activity or in the collection of an unlawful debt, and who have a specified relationship to an enterprise that affects interstate or foreign commerce. Now, a pattern of racketeering activity requires at least two acts of racketeering activity committed within 10 years of each other. Under the RICO statute, racketeering activity includes state offenses involving, and not limited to, things like murder, robbery, extortion, and several other serious offenses punishable by imprisonment for more than 1 year, and more than 100 serious federal offenses, including but not limited to extortion, like we mentioned, interstate theft, narcotics violations, mail fraud, securities fraud, currency reporting violations, certain immigration offenses, and terrorism-related offenses. Now you might be thinking, how do you run afoul of RICO? Under RICO, a person who's committed at least two acts of racketeering activity drawn from a list of 35 crimes, 27 federal crimes, and 8 state crimes within a 10-year period can be charged with racketeering if such acts are related in one of four specific ways to an enterprise. To violate RICO, a person must engage in a pattern of racketeering activity connected to an enterprise. This isn't an exhaustive list, but it's plenty good for our description of the long arms of RICO. Some of those crimes include gambling, murder, kidnapping, extortion, arson, robbery, bribery, dealing in obscene matter, dealing or trafficking a controlled substance or chemical, as well as bribery, counterfeiting, theft, embezzlement, fraud, obstruction of justice, slavery, money laundering, commission of murder for hire, embezzlement of union funds, bankruptcy fraud or securities fraud, criminal copyright infringement, human smuggling, and acts of terrorism. You may be wondering what actions are prohibited by RICO. 18 U.S.C. Section 1962, Prohibited Activities, Section 1962 A, B, and C, set forth the substantive prohibited activities. Section 1962 D, D as in dog, makes it unlawful to conspire to commit any such prohibited activities. Each of these prohibited activities includes, as a necessary element, proof of a pattern of racketeering activity or collection of an unlawful debt, including, but not limited to, the use of income or proceeds from a pattern of racketeering activity by a principal in the commission of that activity to acquire an interest or establish an enterprise engaged in interstate commerce. For example, a narcotics trafficker violates this provision by purchasing a legitimate business with the proceeds of a pattern of multiple drug transactions. Another action that RICO prohibits is the acquisition of any enterprise engaged in interstate commerce through a pattern of racketeering activity. For example, an organized crime figure violates this provision by taking over a legitimate business through a pattern of extortionate acts or arsons designed to intimidate the owners into selling the business to him. RICO also prohibits the operation of an enterprise engaged in interstate commerce through a pattern of racketeering activity. For example, an automobile dealer violates this provision by using the dealership's facilities to operate a stolen car ring through a pattern of predicate violations. In the criminal law of the United States, a predicate crime or offense is a crime which is a component of a larger crime. The larger crime may be racketeering, money laundering, financing of terrorism, etc. For example, to violate the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO, a person must engage in a pattern of racketeering activity and, in particular, must have committed at least two predicate crimes within 10 years. These include bribery, blackmail, extortion, fraud, theft, money laundering, counterfeiting, and illegal gambling. Crimes are predicate to a larger crime if they have a similar purpose to the larger crime. For example, using false identification is itself a crime. It may be a predicate offense to larceny or fraud if it's used to withdraw money from a bank account. Predicate crimes can be charged separately or together with the larger crime. And lastly, but certainly not least, conspiracy to commit any of the above prohibitions. Those are aspects that RICO prohibits. Violations of these prohibitions may be restrained by district courts through the issuance of orders of divestment of a particular company, prohibitions on business activities, and orders of dissolution or reorganization. The Act also establishes clear provisions that state that any person injured in his business or property by reason of a violation of Section 1962 of this chapter may sue and shall recover threefold the damages he sustains and the cost of the suit, including a reasonable attorney's fee. In legal language, civil treble damage actions may also be obtained by the victims of RICO violations. Treble damages is a term that indicates a statute exists to award a prevailing plaintiff up to three times actual or compensatory damages. When we talk about treble damages, in this instance, we're talking about threefold the damages, a tripling. Treble damages differ from the traditional punitive damages in that treble damages are designed to provide additional compensation to the aggrieved party. Unlike traditional punitive damages, treble damages are capped at three times the compensatory finding. Treble damages are designed to deter others from committing the same offense. They are often invoked for willful violations of state or federal statutes. So clearly, for example purposes, if the damages awarded were in the amount of $10 million, it would become $30 million in the blink of an eye. You might be wondering, how long is a RICO sentence? Depending on the underlying racketeering activity, Section 1963A provides criminal penalties ranging from any term of years up to life imprisonment and or a fine, and provides for forfeiture of the defendant's interests in the enterprise connected to the offense and his interests acquired through or proceeds derived from racketeering activity or unlawful debt collection. In simple terms, any number of years to life. Not only does the RICO statute provide for criminal penalties, but the financial penalties are very severe as well. A person convicted can face a fine of either $250,000 or double the amount of proceeds earned from illicit activity, and even the possibility of treble damages, as we just previously mentioned. Section 1963 also permits the government to seek pretrial and, in some cases, pre-indictment restraining orders to prevent the breaking up, selling off, or elimination of assets subject to forfeiture. If you're asking this question, you're on the right track. You might be thinking, what's the government's burden in RICO cases? As in all criminal cases, the burden of proof sits with the prosecution and must be a unanimous decision, which is achieved after a careful consideration of the facts in evidence and a determination reached at a level of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. In practice, in order to be found guilty of violating the RICO statute, the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that an enterprise existed that the enterprise affected interstate commerce, that the defendant was associated with or employed by the enterprise, and that the defendant engaged in a pattern of racketeering activity, and that the defendant conducted or participated in the conduct of the enterprise through that pattern of racketeering activity through the commission of at least two acts of racketeering activity as set forth in the indictment. Let's take a moment and define some very important terms. Now, while our treatment today is by no means exhaustive, we feel that hearing these definitions are essential to the overall learning process. Just as knowing vocabulary words help you to learn and use a foreign language, knowing key terms is essential to any effort at further understanding the process. Now, with that caveat, let's continue to drill down further and define a few very important terms for you. Section 1961, paragraph 3 of RICO defines a person to include any individual or entity capable of holding a legal or beneficial interest in property. Also, an enterprise is defined as including any individual, partnership, corporation, association, or other legal entity, and any union or group of individuals associated in fact, although not a legal entity. And you can find that definition at 18 U.S.C.A. section 1961 paragraph 4. Just as a quick example, an arson ring can be a RICO enterprise, as can a small business or government agency. Let's talk about a pattern as it relates to the RICO statute. A pattern may be comprised of any combination of two or more of these state or federal crimes committed within a statutorily prescribed time period. Moreover, the predicate or underlying acts must be related and amount to or pose a threat of continued criminal activity. Another vocabulary term which will appear on the midterm exam is an unlawful debt. An unlawful debt is a debt that arises from illegal gambling activity or loan sharking activities. Now, as we started out talking initially about Donald Trump, as we press forward, let's work towards tying Trump's case to the topic. By now, almost everyone who watches a news broadcast has heard the amazing recording of the phone call that then President Trump made to Republican Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, asking him to find the precise number of votes needed for Trump to win the election in Georgia, sending the 16 Electoral College votes from Joe Biden's column into his. If by chance you've been living under a rock somewhere and you haven't heard this recording, here is the key part of the phone call. Listen in.
I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state. I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break. There's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that you've recalculated.
Well, Mr. President, the challenge that you have is the data you have is wrong.
Fannie Willis, the district attorney in Fulton County, Georgia, is using the state version of RICO to prosecute the alleged criminal activity of former President Trump and 18 of his co-conspirators. When it is time for her to make her case, she'll use the power that's been vested in RICO to tell an all-encompassing version of the facts, laying out a laundry list of criminal acts, but also identifying the ringleaders and members of the group all working together towards achieving a common, unified goal as part of an enterprise to engage in patterns of illegal activity. This conspiracy has been described to stretch far outside of Fulton County and into several other swing states, a legal move that the racketeering aspect of the RICO statute permits. The scope and breadth of this investigation has a secondary crime scene in Coffee County, Georgia, about 200 miles southeast of Atlanta, where Trump allies got access to voting machines at the start of 2021 in January in search of evidence evidence that didn't exist that the election had been rigged. By lying to the Georgia legislature and state officials, harassing election workers, as well as recruiting fake pro-Trump electors, soliciting the vice president, Mike Pence, and breaching voting machines, all the while engaging in a cover-up rather than accept the outcome and abide by the legal process that was lawfully in place, given the fact that Joe Biden won the election, the defendants allegedly engaged in a criminal racketeering enterprise to overturn Georgia's presidential election results. I would hate, and I repeat, hate, to be caught up on the wrong side of this indictment. Trump's Georgia indictment lays out that at all times relevant to this count of the indictment, the defendants, as well as others not named as defendants, unlawfully conspired and endeavored to conduct and participate in a criminal enterprise in Fulton County, Georgia, and elsewhere. It further purports that this criminal organization constituted an enterprise as that term is defined by being a group of individuals associated in fact. The defendants and other members and associates of the enterprise had connections and relationships with one another and with the enterprise. The enterprise constituted an ongoing organization whose members and associates functioned as a continuing unit for the common purpose of achieving the objectives of the enterprise. The enterprise operated in Fulton County, Georgia, elsewhere in the state of Georgia, in other states, including but not limited to Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, as well as in the District of Columbia, and that the manner and methods used by the defendants and other members and associates of the enterprise to further the goals of the enterprise and to achieve its purposes included, but were not limited to, the following. 1. The making of false statements. 2. And solicitation of state legislatures. 2. Making false statements. 2. And solicitation of high-ranking state officials. Item number 3. The creation and distribution of false Electoral College documents. Number 4. Harassment and intimidation of Fulton County election workers Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss. Number 5. The solicitation of high-ranking United States Department of Justice officials. 6. The solicitation of the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence. 7. The unlawful breach of election equipment in Georgia and elsewhere, and 8th, the obstructive acts in furtherance of the conspiracy and the cover-up. Trust me when I tell you this indictment is blistering in nature. The Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act adds kryptonite to the legal tools in the toolbox in evidence gathering by establishing new penal prohibitions and providing enhanced penalties and new remedies for dealing with the unlawful activities of those engaged in organized crime. The power of RICO lies in its conspiracy provision, based on the rationale, idea, and concept of looking at criminal acts as an organized enterprise, which allows the careful tying together of apparently unrelated crimes with a common objective into a prosecutable pattern of racketeering. In addition, as we previously mentioned, RICO provides for very severe penalties and much enhanced sentences and permits a defendant to be convicted and separately punished for both the underlying crimes that constitute the pattern of racketeering activity and for a substantive violation of RICO. Trust me when I tell you, RICO impacted mob trials like a wrecking ball. Mob families began to crack under the very real threat that members and associates could be indicted en masse for a wide range of criminal activity. Again, as referenced earlier, even the strongest stand-up guy would have trouble facing the 20-year and more sentences that began accompanying RICO convictions. Now, prior to RICO, prosecutors could only try mob-related crimes individually. And since different mobsters perpetrated each crime, the government could only prosecute individual criminals instead of shutting down an entire criminal organization. RICO allows for prosecution of all individuals involved in a corrupt organization. This allows prosecutors to connect crimes that may appear unrelated but have a common, broader objective and bring those crimes together into one case. For mob prosecutions, that means that the government can go after the bosses as well as the hitmen, the capos, and street soldiers. While RICO was originally aimed at the mafia, over the past 37 years, prosecutors have used it to attack many forms of organized crime, such as street gangs, gang cartels, corrupt police departments, and even politicians. For constitutional reasons, the RICO law was drafted so broad that it created civil causes of action against legitimate corporations that commonly are not associated with organized crime. Anyone can bring a RICO prosecution. This process isn't limited to governmental criminal prosecutions. Its reach also entered into civil court actions by laypersons as well. It's been used against all sorts of enterprises, both legal entities such as Arthur Anderson and Company, Cooper's Librand, American Express, and similar pillars of the business world, as well as illegal enterprises such as the Bonanno or Gambino organized crime families. Now, while the world's been focused on Donald Trump's racketeering case, there are other high-profile cases that are very interesting as well, such as Young Thug. I find all this to be very intriguing because right in the very same courthouse where the Trump RICO proceedings are taking place, there's another rather high-profile case that we aren't getting much information on at all. A case also being prosecuted by District Attorney Fannie Willis that has already begun in the state of Georgia involving Jeffrey Williams, the rapper who goes by the stage name of Young Thug, and his associates. The 88-page grand jury indictment characterizes YSL, Young Slime Life, as a criminal street gang and alleges 182 instances of its participating in gang activity and criminal conspiracies, citing lyrics, social media posts, and clothing or accessories with slime emblazoned on them as evidence. Atlanta's Fulton County grand jury charged some individuals with violent crimes that include attempted armed robbery and murder. Not only has the case arrived under the specter of a sharp rise in violent crime in Atlanta, which Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis has promised to fight, but it has reverberated throughout the hip-hop community as well, where many have argued that this trial is but the latest instance of the criminal justice system unfairly tying rappers to violent crime through their art. This case can give us some kind of coming attractions for what may happen in the Trump case. However, as the facts show clearly, this case has been moving like an iceberg, already 15 months into the process since opening arguments. But a lot has transpired. For instance, a piling on of pretrial defense motions, extraordinary security measures, as well as extensive pressure on lower-level defendants to plead guilty, and the case being severed into separate trials, just to name a few of the things that we might see in the Trump case. Young Thug was indicted along with 27 others under Georgia's racketeering influenced and corrupt organizations state law. The charging papers describe a corrupt enterprise whose members shared illegal common goals. The prosecutors in this case submit that Young Thug is a founder of Young Slime Life, or YSL, a criminal street gang whose members were responsible for murders and other violence, as well as drug dealing and property crimes with the purpose of illegally obtaining money and property. Now, for the record, the defendants in this case simply say that YSL is only a record label. But interestingly enough, the case against Young Thug has been pared down from the initial 28 defendants. And as we mentioned, some have had their cases severed because they struggled to find lawyers or were fugitives from justice, among other reasons. This is common in large racketeering cases. Also, the fact that others have accepted plea deals, admitting to actions that they've taken that would serve to save their own hides and serve to convict the remaining defendants. One notable example is Antonio Sledge, also known as Monk Tunk, who recently pled guilty to conspiracy to violate the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act and possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. Sledge accepted 15 years of probation in exchange for his willingness to testify against Young Thug. He will also be required to possess no guns, commit no criminal acts, and submit to random drug tests. And for sure, we can anticipate that there will certainly be some real legal issues that may arise in Georgia v. Trump, similar to those that have kept the Young Thug case stuck in jury selection phase since January. Many potential jurors have claimed that they would face severe hardships if forced to participate in a trial that was originally estimated to last 6 months to a year easily. One juror was asked, and she admitted to knowing the main defendant, Young Thug, and she said that she liked his music, to which she added would make hearing the case surreal. Although she also maintained that she could be impartial in the process of being a juror if seated. But the facts show that the Young Slime Life indictment is much more complex than the Trump case. Young Thug's case described nearly 200 criminal acts as part of a bloody gang war that played out for at least 8 years in a city considered to be a hotbed of innovation in the rap music industry. Both the YSL and Trump indictments paint pictures of multifaceted organizations showing how the defendants are connected and what they are accused of, which are described across multiple pages in the original indictment as acts in furtherance of the conspiracy. These acts include both discernible criminal activity, like murder and aggravated assault in the YSL case, and false statements and writings, which are parallel and very similar in the Trump case with conspiracy to defraud the state. But they also include non-criminal overt acts meant to further the goal of the conspiracy. In the YSL indictment, the overt acts include Young Thug's performing rap songs with violent lyrics, a legal strategy that has set off a heated debate about free speech and whether hip-hop, a quintessentially black art form, is the target of racist scapegoating. Last year, Young Thug's defense team filed a motion seeking to exclude the lyrics from the case, but the judge denied it. And in fact, in a clip widely shared on social media, the judge even read some of the lyrics in question. Now, we thought about playing some for you, some of those lyrics, but honestly, the overwhelming amount of profanity made doing so not the best idea. If you want to hear them, you can find them on YouTube. Now, I'm pretty certain that we can anticipate a similar free speech fight to erupt, at least in court, over Mr. Trump's Twitter posts. Mentions of tweets Trump posted in the months after the 2020 election flood the 98-page indictment as it describes efforts in Washington to set up bogus pro-Trump electors in Georgia and other states, and to trick, cajole, and convince legislators in those states to accept them, and to pressure Mike Pence, then the vice president, to throw a wrench in the final Electoral College vote. While delaying has always been a proven legal tactic, dragging out a case can hurt the prosecution. As witnesses forget or even die, the mere prospect of a multi-year legal ordeal can help convince some defendants to take a plea, as probably happened in the YSL case. Prosecutors often hope to secure pleas from the lower-level players and work up toward the defendant at the top of the list, who is often the most prominent or powerful among them. The goal as a prosecutor is to roll that up like a carpet, working at the bottom and working your way up to the top. The Trump case may prove different from the YSL case in that the rapper's career might survive a guilty plea unless they're deemed snitches, while lawyers convicted of felonies lose their licenses, and there are numerous lawyers on the Trump indictment. Those lawyers may choose to hang on and fight an epic legal battle with Ms. Willis, a formidable prosecutor who's been trying RICO cases for years. Mr. Trump is running for re-election while facing indictments in Florida, New York, and Washington, D.C., as well as in Georgia. If he's concerned about how his legal troubles could affect his popularity, he might find hope in the fact that Young Thug released his latest album while in custody and saw it debut at the top of the Billboard chart this summer. You know, the late Dr. Charles Stanley reminds us that your conduct is defined by your nature. If you don't possess a nature that would drive you to try to hold on to power by any means necessary, taking actions that which might drive you to do corrupt and illegal things to achieve those ends, then you wouldn't undertake any conduct that is illegal. RICO is a very powerful statute. This puts in the prosecutor's hands a variety of criminal remedies that they never had before. When lawyers from the defense bar read RICO, they ask, "My God, how do I defend against that kind of a charge?" That's not the reaction one should have. The question isn't how does an attorney adequately defend charges under RICO. A statute shouldn't be drafted so that it makes it easy to defend against the elements of the charged crime. The purpose of a law isn't to make life easy or hard for a defense counsel. The purpose of the law is to do something about problems in the street and remedy them for the greater good of society as a whole. RICO does something about problems in the street. Trust me that when I tell you that when a person is facing 20 to life, no matter who says you're my boy, you're my homie, my BFF for life, everyone rolls when they're facing that kind of weight and potential time behind bars. For several of the defendants named in the Georgia indictment, 20 years could easily be a death sentence. But then again, the age-old adage that says, "Don't do the crime if you can't do the time," always applies. The purpose of our efforts today was to provide a general overview of the pertinent facts, historical background, and relevant issues regarding the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, commonly referred to as the RICO Act, or simply RICO. The broadcast was not intended nor designed to be a comprehensive compilation of case law addressing these issues or as a substitute for independent research, which we always encourage you to do for yourself. And with this episode, we transmit no legal advice, but with this, we make our legal department very happy. And with that, we want to hear from you. Let us know your thoughts on anything relating to this episode or any episode in our catalog. You can contact us or send me an email at prizzo@rpgconsultingltd.com. That's prizzo@rpgconsultingltd.com. Keep in mind the fact of how much we appreciate you listening, and we now have a global footprint of 103 countries only because of you. The fact remains, we are here for you and because of you. Hey, I'm Phil Rizzo, and you've got Light 'Em Up.
Hey, I want to thank my friends at Innisfree for their promotional products and underwriting. Their fresh-squeezed hydrating green tea, loaded with amino acids and antioxidants, help replenish and neutralize skin for that natural glow. You want to know the best part? Their tea is organically grown and chosen for skincare from 3,301 Korean native green tea varieties. The winning 1-2-3 punch combination consists of the youth enhancing serum with black tea. Then you just dap a little bit of the eye serum underneath your eyes, and finally the enhancing cream. Oh my goodness. Like Muhammad Ali used to say, "I'm pretty, I'm still pretty." They offer innovative beauty solutions for men, also powered by the finest natural ingredients responsibly sourced from Korea's pristine Jeju Island. Their proprietary extraction methods preserve the purity and potency of these wholesome ingredients from plant to bottle to your skin, offering advanced formulas that safely address all skin concerns without the use of harmful chemicals and preservatives. With the wonders of nature at the heart of Innisfree, they take care to preserve and protect the environment in all that they do. We want to thank our friends at Innisfree for their promotional products and underwriting of Light 'Em Up. Hey, don't forget to subscribe to us on YouTube and Instagram at Rizzo's Protective Group. We're very excited about being ranked 10th out of the top 35 criminal justice podcasts as ranked and listed by FeedSpot. Hey, don't forget to subscribe to FeedSpot at www.feedspot.com. And please, por favor, per favore, visit our friends at https://newsly.me. Newsly is an audio app for iOS and Android. It picks up web articles about the most trending topics on the web at any given moment and reads them to you in a natural human voice.
For the first time in the history of the internet, the entire web becomes listenable. You can browse articles from topics you choose and start playing. Hey, stop scrolling, start listening. You can follow any topic, as specific as you like, from sports, science, to Bitcoin. It'll find you the latest articles and read them to you. Hey, it's as easy as that. And to top it off, they have podcasts as well. Explore trending podcasts from over 50 countries. Our podcast, Light 'Em Up, is there too. I started using it as my default podcast app, and you can too. Download and use Newsly for free now from www.newsly.me or from the link in the podcast description liner notes and use the promo code Light 'Em Up. And Light 'Em Up in this case is spelled LGHTEMUP. All one word. That's L1GHTEMUP. All one word.